From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, as the Democratic National Convention comes to an end. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. As the drama of the Democratic National Convention unfolded in Philadelphia this past week, we served up daily news interviews with diverse voices from across the political spectrum. On this week's State of Belief Radio, you'll hear highlights of those conversations. To watch videos of the week's coverage in full, I invite you to visit stateofbelief.com. I was joined in Philadelphia by Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance, and George Washington University Assistant Professor of Political Management, Greg LaBelle. You'll hear from both later in the hour. I was also thrilled to speak once again with Sister Simone Campbell, who brought the nuns on the bus to both national conventions this year. I talked with a Hillary surrogate, a member of the platform drafting committee, and a number of lawmakers and faith leaders. We also got a conservative take on the DNC from journalist Josh Crusher and Audrey Mullen. But we'll start with Rabbi J. Michelson, author, activist, and attorney, who sat down with me at table 102 on Radio Row of the Wells Fargo Center. What have you observed, and what are the feelings that go with it?
Well, I think for me, you know, there is kind of a narrative that's happened, I think, of a little disunity at the beginning and some coming together as we've gone on. You know, I think part of that obviously was resolving, you know, some of the mistreatment that Bernie and his supporters received from the party. And I feel like although we'll never really make up for some of that, I think there's been some coming together. Been a lot of really high-profile Bernie supporters now very strongly endorsing Hillary, not holding their nose in voting, but actually, right. You know, really saying what's good and progressive about her. And I think that's part of it. I think the second part is that I think there was just a hangover from the darkness of the Republican convention. You know, this wasn't just another Republican convention. It wasn't Mitt Romney that they were nominating. You know, this was something where people were calling for our candidate, the Democratic candidate, to be shot or to be imprisoned and chants going on and openly fascistic imagery used in the nomination process. And I think there was a little bit of a hangover. So the feeling that I get now is that now that we're rolling on this convention, a little bit of retaking the narrative. President Bill Clinton's message last night, you know, was very spiritual in nature and almost like a pastor's, you know, sermon a little bit. Obviously, Michelle Obama's speech the previous night. And so I feel like there's a little bit more of a positive narrative, at least from my perception.
Yeah.
I just did a piece, actually, for The Forward talking about two elephants in the room. Those two are kind of ISIS and Islamism, and the second being Hillary Clinton's own popularity issues. Right. You know, there were some very weird elephants in the room back in the Elephants Convention last week. You would almost think, like, Black Lives Matter wasn't a thing or racial justice wasn't a thing. And, you know, there were just all these issues that were never spoken of. You know, here I have seen a little less attention given to some of the real security concerns that a lot of Americans have. And I think that's going to change tonight, tomorrow night, as it comes in the themes on the floor. But I do think there's a weird cognitive dissonance that's happening, that a lot of what America is concerned about, we're not necessarily talking about because it's not on message for the Democratic Party. You know, I think the second elephant in the room for me was Hillary Clinton's negatives, and I think Bill Clinton addressed that a little bit last night, and I know other speakers will and have as well. And I was glad to see that elephant in the room at least talked about. But I do think there's an air of unreality. A lot of the sessions that I've gone to is at the faith panel and the Jewish roundtable, LGBT roundtable. Sometimes it's like in an alternate universe where we're not living under the envelope of encroaching fascism.
Yes. I want to stay with Hillary's problem just for a little bit. She has said very little about it. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, she's got better, more experienced political advisors than I, but, you know, it does not strike me as very authentic to just ignore the main concern, especially because I think there are legitimate answers to that. You know, my take on Hillary's negatives is that it's a combination of sexism on the one hand and 30 years of Republican attacks on the other. You know, I think we as a culture have certain assumptions or judgments about what, you know, what authenticity sounds like and what reliability sounds like. You know, you live with that for 20, 30 years. Some people are going to feel that you're inauthentic because you've been coached and prodded and pushed so much. And she's her own person. But I think it's inevitable that some of those very gendered understandings, sexist understandings of what it is to be, you know, a good old boy. And I think Bill Clinton talked about that a little bit more on the Republican attack side, that they've created this fantasy image. You know, I'd like Hillary to take the bull by the horns and recognize that there are a lot of people who have a fundamental mistrust of her and point to her record, her actual record, not the fictional one, and really call people out and come up with specific, you know, examples. The fact that we're, you know, the Republican Party wants us to focus on a couple of emails when their candidate has had 600 lawsuits and allegations of fraud at every stage of his career, you know, is just unbelievable. And even if there was some a lapse in judgment, as Hillary Clinton's admitted on this email thing, it's so minuscule compared to what we're talking about. And that's before all of this stuff, you know. I mean, Trump just arguably just committed treason today, calling for a foreign president to hack, you know, the Democratic Party. Right. And that is, every time we think he's off the charts, he finds a new chart to get off of. You know, I think we could take the bull by the horns a little bit and really make this case. Like, we see the concern. And same thing on terrorism. The fear is there. You know, we may say it's out of proportion or this or that, but the fear is real. And I think on this side, there are a lot of good people with good answers to that and how to work with that. And I think it would be a mistake to leave that on the table.
That's why I wanted to know what you felt and what you thought, and it's helpful to know that.
Well, thank you. You know, at the end of every one of our conversations, I end up, you know, promoting you and saying that, you know, this is what we do need, a kind of spiritual progressive voice more out there, because we're dealing with a spiritual crisis right now. And I'm not saying religious necessarily.
No,
I don't think
I understand.
We have to go into a narrow definition of what that means.
Right.
But there is a profound sense of dislocation and loss.
Yes.
And, it, you know, if we don't recognize that, we're not going to be able to address it.
That's
and
right.
The other side has figured out how to bring together the spiritual and the political, right? You know, scaring the hell out of everyone and saying there's one big, you know, father figure who's going to make us safe, you know, Comrade Stalin or otherwise. Yeah. Interestingly, I did see a little of that last night in Bill Clinton's speech on the positive side, you know, saying how the issues that he and Hillary have cared about for 40 years are not just kind of a laundry list of liberal concerns, but were part of their spiritual quest for justice. Now, how true that is or not, I'm not going to go into that. But as a message, as a narrative, I think that's a compelling narrative, because it's not just about, you know, a living wage here and, you know, recycling there, but it's actually about justice. And I just wish that the word justice and social justice hadn't been turned into a swear word. We have different views of what that means, and that's healthy and robust. And I think the Sanders camp has a lot to say, and I think the Clinton camp has a lot to say. But we do have something to say about justice, and that's not making America great again back when we had Jim Crow or sexism or homophobia. You know, I think there was a beautiful line Bill Clinton said that, you know, our greatness has to be in the future because we're trying to create a more perfect union. And to me, that's what spirituality and justice work are all about.
During our week at the Democratic National Convention, I had the chance to interview former Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa. How is the convention going for you?
Well, I think really well. I was very proud of Bernie Sanders last night when he very courageously said that he wanted to suspend the rules and have them nominate Hillary Clinton by acclamation. Mm-hmm. That was really big of him to do that. And we had some Bernie Sanders supporters in our delegate. I was a Hillary delegate, but a couple of them took off their Bernie stickers and put on Hillary Clinton. So I think we're going to come out of this just fine.
Great.
Yeah.
What, for you personally and for Iowa, what are particularly important concerns related to this convention?
What's important is what direction is our country going to go in? Are we going to continue this kind of spinning out of control and atomizing everybody, where we're just a bunch of little individuals running around without any connection with one another? Mm-hmm. Or are we going to really understand that, as Hillary says, we are stronger together,
right?
Working together? Yeah, we have our differences, but what draws us together is much more important in our society. And will we come out of this with a decency, an understanding, as I said, where every person is respected and valued and treated with dignity? What Donald Trump stands for and how he's saying things, I know it has an appeal to a certain subset of Americans, mm-hmm. but that's anger, it's fear, and it's hatred of people. And while that kind of an approach always has certain appeals to certain segments of America going back mm-hmm. in our history, it's always been a minority. They always get marginalized. And I think that's what gives me faith and hope that out of this will come a kind of a resurgence of more of an understanding of our commonality and our yes. common good. Yes.
If you had a minute or two with Donald Trump, what would you say to him?
I would say, Donald, be kind. Be understanding. Have this understanding that human nature can both be resolute and frail at the same time. Mm-hmm. And Donald, you've leaned more towards that resolute, that toughness and stuff, but sometimes humans can be very frail too, and you have to have that understanding. And that sometimes beneath a veneer of calmness and determination, that kind of thing, sometimes beneath that may be a troubled soul.
Mm.
And being harsh and mean to people, that doesn't help that person. That maybe on the outside everything is fine, but inside something's going on.
Yeah.
And you have to understand that frailty of human nature.
I also spoke to Representative John Larson of Connecticut. As you come to this convention, what are your expectations?
Well, the expectation, I think, coming to any convention is to come out of here unified. And we had a very spirited contest for the president, but I think there's very little distance between the thinking of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and especially on the issues that matter most to people. I do expect that we're going to come out of here unified and, you know, on the side of people. I mean, we're here at Nuns on the Bus, et cetera. And if you look at their agenda is synonymous with our platform on our committee. And so we feel that we're close to the people. We're on the side of the angels, or at least the nuns.
Well, listen, people of faith in this election cycle have been hearing lots of different things about what religious freedom means. Tell me what you see as real religious freedom and where you stand on that.
Well, religious freedom, I think, as guaranteed by the Constitution, gives everyone the right to worship whomever they choose or decide. Whatever God they believe in or not, they have the right. And whether you're an atheist or whether you're an agnostic, you have the right to those beliefs. And, you know, certainly in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we're most familiar with those. But the great teachings of Islam, the great teachings of Buddha, you know, you can go throughout the world and look at other religions that we can all learn from. And it's not just a question of being tolerant, which, of course, everyone should, but trying to understand. That's a great thing that the Nuns on the Bus do, reaching across denominations and reaching across to people, and at the end of the day bringing them together. You know, after all, it's we the people in order to form a more perfect union.
Congressman Larson made a good point about the DNC platform reflecting the agenda of the Nuns on the Bus. The sisters were there in force with three panels on the convention schedule and a chance for me to spend a few times with Sister Simone Campbell. I'm really curious. You were at the Republican convention
yep.
last week. You're at the Democratic convention this week.
Yep.
Is there a different feel?
It's night and day. It's night and day. I mean, we just got here this morning, but walking the streets, there's so much more joy. There's so much more engagement. There's like a feeling of hope. And the crowd is so much more diverse, I have to tell you. In Cleveland, we had nothing but serious, grim, tight faces hurrying past or stopping for lemonade but not sure they could trust it kind of feeling. And the thing that I think was most distressing is they had a hard time thinking of hope. They couldn't tell us what gave them hope. But what we find here is people bubbling over with hope, bubbling over with opportunity and ideas and engagement and passion and life, in short, life. I mean, so many people at the Republican convention told me, they worry there's not a good candidate to pick. And here at the Democratic convention, we hear, we've got two great candidates, and I want one, and I want another. But there's engagement.
So if you were orchestrating this convention, what would be the most important thing you would tell them to do?
The thing that everybody needs to do, whether they're at this convention or not, is get engaged, mend the gaps. But people think you have to be in the political party and all the structure. No. We just have to talk to each other about what matters to each one of us in our hearts. And then together we can figure out how we move forward.
You know how concerned I am you are. Interfaith Alliance is about religious freedom.
Oh, absolutely.
Say a word about the importance of religious freedom for both of these conventions.
Well, I mean, one thing is, I think that nuns on the bus is at both conventions, that we're able to use our faith voice to speak to values and to speak to what matters. Too often, I think we politicians may want to co-opt us or to suppress us because we don't agree with them, and or that because we agree with them, they want to trot us out. The fact is that we come from a place of belief and faith. I just got asked if I would be willing to be a surrogate for Secretary Clinton, and I said, well, the fact is I speak for mending the gaps.
Right.
I don't speak for a candidate. If I can say that the assessment is between the two candidates we have right now, who would mend the gaps? Well, I've got an analysis of that. I'm happy to give it. But it's out of faith that we have to be free to express the values and then help people make their decisions.
During our week-long coverage of the Democratic National Convention, I wanted to get a conservative take on the proceedings. Here are highlights from my time with Josh Crusher, politics editor of National Journal, and Audrey Mullen, partner at Advocacy, Inc.
I know you were at the Republican Convention. You're now here in the Democratic Convention. I'd like to know how you see the two conventions compared to each other.
It's like night and day. I mean, the level of chaos is significant at both for different reasons. For the Republicans, it was the chaos that developed when Ted Cruz refused to endorse the nominee, and the party was trying to coalesce itself behind Donald Trump. The first day here was unlike anything I've seen in my 15 or so years of covering politics. The outright opposition from the hardline Bernie Sanders delegates booing any mention of Hillary Clinton. As someone who usually sees these conventions as a scripted, unifying affair, it was stunning to see someone who is well-liked among the Democratic rank and file to be received by the left in such a negative way. Even when Bernie Sanders is telling his supporters support Hillary Clinton, they're still having trouble coming to grips with reality.
Talk for a minute about how the religious right has not gone as they would be predictably going in this.
That is one of the most fascinating subplots in this election. Donald Trump has essentially given the middle finger to social conservatives in the Republican Party, and yet they've gone along with him for the most part. There have been some prominent holdouts, some leaders in the evangelical movement. But when you look at the voters, and you look at someone like a Jerry Falwell Jr., who was one of Donald Trump's early supporters, and you know, even leaders and political leaders in the social conservative movement agreeing to Mike Pence, for one, his running mate, deciding to, instead of holding out or deciding not to be on his ticket, deciding to join with the Trump movement and serve as Trump's running mate. Power is a very seductive thing on, you know, both sides. And now that Trump controls much of the party infrastructure, at least until November, it's really giving Republicans who normally would be against Trump and normally don't agree with his positions on social issues a real difficulty in figuring out how to balance their priorities and their principles.
We're joined again by a good friend, Aubrey Mullen. The last time we were together, we were at the Republican National Convention. Mm-hmm. Audrey, do you notice much difference between the women and the men in the conventions? Just the behavior of the crowd? Is that
No, not really. I have noticed more all gender bathrooms, but that seem to have been taken from the women's rooms. There is absolutely no potty parity here. So they have all been taken from the ladies' rooms, which are in shorter supply in arenas than they should be. But that's really it.
How about the crowds? I remember the very loud crowds at the Republican convention and very loud crowds here. They're very different.
Yes, the very loud crowd here was the Bernie protesters walking out yesterday.
Right.
And it's been very interesting. I mean, there were a lot of people in Cleveland who certainly were not Donald Trump supporters, but they did not have a well-organized floor protest, mm-hmm. and there certainly wasn't a fear of a walkout. Mm-hmm. I think that they pretty much knew the results before they went in. The Bernie people seem to have held out a bit more hope, and so there was the possibility that there would be some sort of unrest,
yes.
and there was. And I think that, you know, it speaks to the need for both parties to listen to their grassroots, and people just aren't being heard.
I mean, do we have two divided conventions?
Well, between the populists and the elitists, certainly, yeah, to some degree. And I think that part of it is the way delegates are selected. Democrats do have a lot of superdelegates. Republicans have superdelegates who may be party chairs or something like that. Democrats have a lot of superdelegates who are simply big donors. Mm-hmm. And that makes the people who can't afford to give six figures feel like they're being used to do things like leaflet neighborhoods and volunteer, but that at the end of the day, that their voices aren't as important.
At the DNC, I spoke with Stash Kotler, CEO of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. What's impressed you the most since this is your first one?
This moment that we're in feels so critical and historic and decisive. And I think all of us understand what's at stake right now in our country.
Talk about your organization so people will know what the relationship is.
Yeah. So Bend the Arc, a Jewish Partnership for Justice, and our 501c4 organization, Bend the Arc Jewish Action. We are a national Jewish organization that focuses exclusively on domestic public policy. So we work on issues such as racial justice, economic inequality, voting rights, criminal justice, LGBT rights. The core issues that many Americans and certainly American Jews care deeply about. And we've been working for the last 6 months at least, very specifically on making sure that Donald Trump is not elected president of the United States. It's what we've been doing with Bend the Arc Jewish Action. We've held national mass actions across the country. Just a few weeks ago, we did an action where over 3,000 people took action in over 50 cities to say that the Jewish community rejects Donald Trump and Trumpism and all that he stands for. We're now in another phase of our campaign where we're ramping up, where we're going to continue to do digital organizing, online media, other national days of action. And then we're also working to send Jews who are living in safe states into swing states to do voter contact with low-frequency voters as well as contact with Jewish voters who may not yet have made up their mind. And for us to really demonstrate that Jewish values are about reflecting the human dignity of all people. The Jewish values are about protecting the stranger. The Jewish values are about caring for the underdog community, those that are the most vulnerable, and that Donald Trump's presidential campaign and his candidacy and the movement that actually supports him are the antithesis of Jewish values.
If you had two or three minutes with Donald Trump and you could say to him anything you wanted to say, what would you say to him?
My inclination is to, from a human level, just let him know how hurtful his leadership has been and the consequence that I believe he understands. I suppose if I was giving him the benefit of the doubt, maybe he doesn't fully understand it, but I would want to sit with him and actually express to him the fear that he's created in communities. I'd want to express to him the actual physical danger that he's put people in, the degree to which he has unleashed a movement who had sentiments of racism and xenophobia already within it, but he's now given that movement permission to be much more dangerous and overt. And I would want to look him in the eye and just tell him as a human being to another human being that this is, it's devastating. And I don't believe that I would persuade him in any way, shape or form, but I would actually want him to sit with the reality of his decisions.
And of course, I spent the week with my roommate, Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance.
Jack, I last night heard two or three speakers make the point that Muslims being banned from this nation because they're Muslims just isn't a part of the United States Constitution. I want you to distinguish the good way to refer to faith in situations like this and where you shouldn't go with that.
So every American has freedom of conscience. It's guaranteed by the First Amendment, and there should be no investigation of whether someone meets a litmus test or subscribes to a certain set of principles as somebody blessed to be a part of the citizenry of the United States. So that's the right way to go about it, is to affirm that whether you profess a faith or you profess no faith, and whichever faith or no faith you profess, it's irrelevant to both the privileges and responsibilities of citizenship. The wrong way to do it is to establish that it's fine to be a Jew, it's fine to be a Muslim, it's fine to be a Hindu, as long as you're a good Christian. And and that's what we hear too much of in the discussion of faith and values from people who are far to the right of center.
Yeah. So how would you talk about your faith, the Jewish faith? How would you talk about your faith in this setting?
There's a principle in Judaism. In Aramaic, it's Dina de Malchuta Dina, which it's a felicitous sounding phrase, but the translation is equally felicitous. The law of the land is the law, except in those matters which govern our personal religious conduct. We are obligated as faithful Jews to obey the law of the land. And what I would suggest is that that's something we can offer as a universal approach to religious faith in this country. Mm-hmm. Everyone has the right to do what they need to do religiously and what they are to refrain from religiously, to view some practices to be sinful and others to be obligatory, as long as they don't cross the line into what is the commonly accepted standards as defined by law and especially our Constitution.
We started with faith and values. Let's end with faith and values. Give me a good wrap-up statement on faith and values.
The ideas that inspire us are welcome in the public square. The practices that divide us should be kept at home.
Our good friend Mike McBride has stopped by while we're here at the Democratic National Convention.
Thank you, man, for coming to our session. We just finished up a session on urban gun violence, and thank you for being here.
Talk about what you just talked about.
We talked about the importance of the Democratic Party candidates up and down the ballot, expanding the conversation around gun violence prevention to be inclusive of programs and intervention strategies. We know that when these tragic killings happen at any level, usually the default position of most political conversations happen with only background checks. We need to limit the accessibility of guns. But part of what we want to also talk about is the demand side. How do we actually lower people's demand or need to feel like they have to use a gun?
I keep running into people when we talk about Black Lives Matter who say, well, all lives matter. I have an answer for that, but I'd much rather hear your answer to it.
Well, I think the most disingenuous part of the response to Black Lives Matter, saying all lives matter, is that it is an attempt to negate the truth or at least minimize the need to say that Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. I heard Bishop T.D. Jakes say it best that, you know, he probably, if it was him, would say Black Lives Matter too. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'll just invite people to add the T-O-O onto every time someone says Black Lives Matter, if that's what you need to do in order to hear the truth of what is being said. The affirmation of Black lives is not the negation of anyone else's life. But there is a unique challenge we're facing right now with the vulnerability of Black lives, brown lives, poor lives in this country that requires a public affirmation. Mm-hmm. Let us not be ahistorical and forget that it has not been one day in the history of this country that Black lives have not been subjected to arbitrary violence at the hands of the state or vigilantes. So we have to begin to imagine what then is the collective responsibility of our country to ensure that the lives of Black folk, the bodies of Black people, are equally protected under the law, and that we have the ability to have due process even when we show our humanity by making mistakes or errors of judgment.
As part of our week-long coverage of the DNC, I spoke with folks intimately involved in the convention process. Here are excerpts with Paul Booth, a lifelong political activist who served on the platform drafting committee, and Susan Turnbull, a surrogate for nominee Hillary Clinton. Paul, was the debate on the platform for this year a difficult one for you?
Well, it was contentious only because the differences, although not great, were magnified by the fact that the campaign continued after the primaries and that the platform drafting became the last arena of competition between the two campaigns. Mm-hmm. And so when you're in a competitive campaign, of course, you magnify the differences, and the job of the platform committee was not only to allow those to be aired and ventilated and magnified and argued, but also to be reconciled, mm-hmm. which we succeeded in doing. And that's a piece of work that we can all take great pride in.
Do you have the sense that the party will leave here being united?
Yes. I mean, there'll be some drop-off. There's some of the Sanders people were Bernie or bust and still are, and I think they will find their way to some third alternative. I'm worried about that because when people like that were attracted to Ralph Nader in 2000, it ended up swinging the election to George Bush. And what did we have under George Bush? We had the massive tax break for the rich, and we had the invasion of Iraq continuing to have adverse evil consequences in our world, in the Middle East and beyond. And I don't want to see that mistake making again, and I'm going to make sure that everybody I know who's thinking about staying home or sitting on their hands understands that they'll have their kids and their grandchildren to answer for that if they do.
What's your favorite part of a Democratic convention?
Well, let's see. I believe that the Democratic convention's use of prime time, that the speeches that they line up and the people who get to stand up and deliver those. And then I love the diversity. The people, and it's a contrast with the Republicans, unfortunately, but the slice of America that you get here is a real slice of America. Working people, people of every background, and women and men, and people with all here with passion, but representing all aspects of what makes America such a wonderful and diverse country. Diversity is our strength, not our problem.
Susan Turnbull, I welcome you to State of Belief Radio. Tell me what it's like to be a surrogate with Hillary Clinton.
I actually posted a Facebook post today, which isn't really a being a surrogate, but in some ways that's the next generation of surrogacy. And I talked about how I've known Hillary Clinton for the last more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. And in those 20 years, she's asked me about my kids, my grandson. She's asked me about what I think about and care about. She's whispered in my ear. That's a real person, and I'm really happy to be here supporting her.
What do you know about Hillary that other people need to know that they probably don't know?
I could tell you an interesting story.
Okay.
Many, many years ago, I was at an event at the White House, and someone told me that Hillary had just been into many Eastern European countries. And one of those countries was Ukraine, and she was in a town called Lviv, which is a large city, but people in America don't know much about it.
Yeah.
It is very close to where my father grew up. And I had mentioned to someone on the staff that my father had grown up right there. And so when I saw Hillary, I said, I understand you were in Lviv. And she looked at me, and she put her hand on my shoulder, and she said, Susie, you should have seen the synagogue. And I looked at her, and I said, you know, it's very possible that my father had been in that synagogue.
Hmm.
And she said, well, I'm going to be talking at the State Department. Maybe you can come and see my presentation.
My goodness.
Now, people like that are real people who have real cares. And it was the first time in my life that I had ever talked to someone who had been where my father had grown up, who could talk about it in that way.
Yeah. Susan, is this going to be a tough race right up until Election Day?
It is, because it's been an uncharacteristic race. And, I mean, we're talking, everybody knows, we're talking about reality versus reality TV. They're quite different. I think what Donald Trump did today was irresponsible. He does that every day. And this is too serious. The idea of someone who is not only persecuting specific religions, but also persecuting people who really don't think the way he does. And that is not the America that we all stand for. The America we all stand for is why we held our signs last night, and why everyone was touched when Michelle Obama talked about waking up in a place that was built by slaves.
My name is Amna Hashmi, and I'm a delegate from Maryland.
What are you looking for most in this convention?
For me, I have been looking to just be inspired. You know, these conventions, it's about reiterating the Democratic platform and then going back to your communities, representing your communities, and getting them to register and vote. So for me, I am looking for the best arsenal of tools that I can have to go back to my communities mm-hmm. and really feel like I voiced what they're feeling and their beliefs to people in power here.
I'm curious as to how you and your colleagues in the Muslim community have felt about some of the rhetoric on targeting Muslims for persecution, but exclusion.
No, I mean, I even think persecution is the right word. I find it absolutely despicable. I think the fact that Donald Trump can imply that he should ban all Muslims, and then he backtracks and said, oh, well, it's only going to be a temporary ban, or it's only going to be on non-citizen Muslims. The fact that I don't know what he believes on something that's so extreme and blames an entire religious group for something that a few extremists do mm-hmm. is absolutely abhorrent. Since he has started running, and from November 2015, the number of hate crimes against Muslims have tripled in this country, according to a public policy center. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do with that. You can't tell when looking at me that I'm Muslim. I don't wear hijab. A lot of my friends don't know I'm Muslim. I don't pray five times a day. But I still very much consider myself Muslim due to the community that I grew up in. I celebrate Eid. I have this entire collection of khalas and mm-hmm. uncles and aunties who I cannot imagine my life without. And that those ties are largely because we're in the Muslim community. And so for us, this election is personal. You know, it's a choice between being welcome and included in this country when so many Muslims have contributed so much to this country. And I feel like I'm contributing so much to this country. I just graduated from Harvard. I'm working at a health technology startup doing software engineering for the purpose of improving health outcomes. I am going to Stanford Business School for the purpose of starting my own company in the health space. I feel American. I'm a part of this country, and I'm trying so hard to serve it.
I want to know, because I can't identify with the feelings that you must be having in your community. Talk about what hearing that from a national leader does.
I am terrified. I'm terrified of the prospect of Donald Trump being president. I am afraid. I am scared. It hurts. It hurts in a way where it echoes inside of your bones, inside of your soul, and you think, how could he say that about me, about my parents, about my friends? When Obama visited a mosque this year, and he said, you're not Muslim or American, you're Muslim and American, I just started sobbing.
Sure.
I'm not someone who's particularly conflicted about being Muslim. I don't feel targeted personally, but him saying that, I needed it. Mm-hmm. It was such a validation of my identity here and of my parents who've worked so hard. It feels like a slap in the face. Mm-hmm. It feels like whatever I've done to be here and to serve here has been worthless.
We'll wrap up this week's show with a few impressions from Philadelphia, courtesy of Greg LaBelle, who teaches political management at George Washington University and has worked inside several presidential campaigns. Last night, on the next to the last night of the convention, as Jack Moline and I tried to exit, we could not get out because there were protests going on outside and we had to change our direction. But there also been protests inside.
Yeah.
Talk about those.
Yeah. What I think is interesting about this is the folks who are protesting now are actually protesting really against their candidate, because Bernie Sanders has been magnanimous and very clear in his support for Secretary Clinton as the nominee. So I find it interesting that these folks are really now sort of taking on the guy who they felt was their leader. But it's much, much, much muted from where we were when we got here on Monday.
I thought one of the most moving parts of this whole week was when the mothers of some of the young black men who have been killed came together for a time last evening. Talk about that, if you will.
It was heartrending. It was beautiful. It was powerful. These women presented themselves in a powerful, positive way. The first woman who spoke, she basically said, we're not here because God has not been good to us. We're here because God is great and God is good. And that set the tone for that beautiful presentation by these mothers who are dealing with the losses of their children. It was just full of compassion and love, and it was very, very moving. And another point I remember was a woman said that she continues to be the voice of her daughter, and that's what keeps her going. She said, I'm still a mother. My daughter's gone, but I'm still a mother. It was powerful. It was beautiful. And I hope people in this country were listening to this and hearing it, because it
right.
was really
I do too.
A high point.
Well, let's go to President Barack Obama. I seldom have or maybe never heard him any better than he was.
Yeah, I've seen him give four convention speeches now. I was in Boston when he gave that speech as the keynoter, and I've seen his two acceptance speeches in Denver and then Charlotte. And this was at least on a par with those, and as you say, very possibly the best of his speeches. He did a beautiful job. The thing that I keep remembering is when he said, there's no one better prepared for the presidency than Hillary Clinton, including me. And he looked at President Clinton out there and said, and including you, Bill. And I thought, that takes a lot. When you think about it, that takes a lot for a president to say, I think. And he, it's clear that those two have forged a really close and important alliance and friendship. And it was clear not only in his words, but you could read Hillary Clinton's face when she came out at the end. This was a really important speech. It was heartfelt. These two really, really ended up liking each other 8 years after what was a really difficult nomination process.
You know, I've not done much on trying to compare the two conventions. I've asked a lot of people questions about that. But there was something almost intangible about the softness and sensitivity with which the president spoke, even though he was also talking about some really difficult matters.
Yeah, yeah. If I were to characterize the difference, I would put it this way. The Republican convention was built on the premise that when things get tough, we turn on each other. This convention seems to be turning on the idea that when things get tough, we turn to each other. And I really think that that's the difference. I will tell you, my students were interviewed this morning by one of the television affiliates, and they drew that distinction in the discussion. That significant the sense of not only tolerance here now, and they were of mixed backgrounds, and they said that the inclusion, the welcomeness that they feel here was something that seemed very different from what was going on in Cleveland. So, you know, that, at least to them, that difference really, really came through.
There have been discussions of the violence that goes on in our streets right now. There have been discussions of ISIS, but there have not been overstatements about those things. There's not been a sense of panic about those things.
I do think there are stark differences in the philosophies of the two parties here. The Trump doctrine, if you will, seems to be win, win, win at all costs. Whatever we have to do, bomb them, do whatever we need to do to win. That was loudly cheered, I think, in Cleveland. And I think the Democratic philosophy is very different, but I think somewhat harder to present in a situation like this. And I think it really is a continuation of what President Obama has tried to do in these troubled spots, which is to take the long view, to figure out how we work together with our allies and how we begin to change and develop our relationships with these folks who have been our enemies. And that's kind of a hard message to put into a 30-second spot or whatever. So I think the Democrats are at a bit of a disadvantage message-wise. But I think there is a serious commitment here to taking that approach. So, yeah, they may have soft-pedaled it a little bit in the context of the convention. We'll see what they do with it once we get out of here and we're in the back in the rough and tumble of day-to-day campaign. But I think there clearly is a difference. And I think we'll have to see them develop that over the next few months.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. It's been an exciting week here in Philadelphia, and there's no way to fit all of the conversations that we recorded into one show. So I invite you to visit stateofbelief.com and take a look at all of the video clips from the convention. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the ongoing discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what?